What up, super friends? Isela here. No rapping for me. Last time I tried that, I got strangely misogynistic. Sorry, getting off topic. In response to the really kind people who've reached out asking how they can support us, we've set up a Patreon. We're so legit now. One might say we're too legit to quit. We know subscriptions are sucky, but we've made it super easy to sign up. And best of all, it is dirt cheap, y'all. Only $2 a month. You can't even buy a single Savage Smoked Slim Jim for that money. For $2, you'll get our episodes a week early and ad-free. Also, we're going to send you some fun and cool stickers a few times a year, along with a shout-out during one of our episodes. You will be known to us as the most super of our super friends. Link is in the show notes, or check us out on patreon.com/technicallyaconversation.
Few alien abduction stories are as well known as Travis Walton's. His story inspired a best-selling book and the movie Fire in the Sky. For those unfamiliar, Walton claims he was abducted on November 5th, 1975, while returning home from logging at the Sitgreaves National Forest in Arizona. His disappearance made international news, and he didn't reappear until 5 days later. But there are a lot of interesting and suspicious details surrounding his alleged abduction. Today, we'll discuss his story in detail, what the facts are as we know them, and what really might have been the motivation behind his abduction story on this episode of Technically a Conversation. Greetings, you're listening to Technically a Conversation, a podcast where we share an interesting topic or story with each other and hope you find it interesting as well. I'm one half of your host, Jose, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-host, Elena. How are you doing today?
Splendid. How are you?
I'm doing great also. It's kind of funny that in the last episode, you called me your music-loving brother.
Yes.
Because I've actually been playing a lot with music lately, so that's always fun.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember my friend Mark. He used to sing for the metal band Aurora Underwater.
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Well, he was part of a death metal singing contest or something like that a couple of weeks ago. So I recorded him here in my little studio, and the song came out surprisingly good.
Cool.
He was actually super happy with the way that it came out, and he wants me to work with him on another song soon. So that'll be fun.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and he's got a great metal voice, so it's pretty good. I'll link to it in the show notes if anybody wants to check it out. I think he put it on YouTube.
For sure. Yes.
I also started messing around with AI to make music. Are you familiar with AI?
I am. I have used it.
Oh, you have? All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a product of the 80s and 90s. So when I think of AI, I think of Skynet and the Terminators destroying humanity and leaving nothing but ash and bones behind as proof of their devastation. Now, we're not going to destroy the world with this, but there is a new program called Udio that allows you to type in some terms and it'll actually create a song for you. So I asked it to create a theme song for our show, and I was actually pretty impressed with a couple of the results. Would you like to hear them?
Of course, yes.
Okay, so I'll play the one that I was least impressed by first.
Okay.
And then I'll play the one that I actually kind of liked. The first one is called Convergence Core.
All right.
Minds align in the digital sphere. Ideas strike, cutting through like a spear. Through the noise, they're bringing the truth near. It's aimless when it lays us cheer and no days care. Across the waves, their bands are crystal clear. Exchange intellect they revere. Voices clash in a vibrant tide. Discourse flows, they won't subside. Exchanging tales,
drives with passion.
That was awesome.
It's not bad, huh, for being done with AI?
Yeah, I was trying to catch all of the lyrics and I heard something about your chair, Jose's chair. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then at the end, it said all of our names, but...
Yeah, it says our names throughout the whole song.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't... On my end, I can't hear it that great. I know, like, when I listen to it, when you air it, I will be able to hear it a lot better. But it's kind of like when you did the Misfits show that Isela and I were having a hard time like hearing the song.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, I caught a few things, but that was pretty cool. I enjoyed it. Okay, what's next?
All right, so this one was the one that I was most impressed by. This one is called The Dawn of Discourse.
Okay.
I thought it was really good. The outro sounds like some bullshit from Avantasia and just ends abruptly.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest is actually really good.
Okay.
Jose with wit, his humor's charm, a beacon in the discourse storm. With every topic there unwinding, a symphony of minds aligning. The chorus of the age they're calling, on airwaves where the truth is dawning.
Fearlessly crusading, technically a conversation, enlightening, unfading.
What'd you think?
I like the first one better.
Really?
Yes.
I don't know. That second one has been living rent free in my mind since I created it.
It's funny. I mean, it's pretty awesome, but. Like, the guy says my name correctly, but the girl does not. She calls me Alina. It is not Alina. It's Elena.
Yeah, that's AI for you. And they're called hallucinations.
I just wonder, like, who these people are. Like, who are the ones that are actually singing this?
I don't know. Like, it pretty much created both songs in, like, less than a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, who knows?
That's cool. That's so cool. You got to use them like interchangeably, but you do. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it was fun.
For sure.
All right. Enough fucking around, Elena. Ready to get started?
I'm ready.
Great. Let's get started. So I know that there is one alien abduction movie that has always terrified you.
Yes.
I want to say that you mentioned it when we discussed Amupac, the alien base protecting Mexico from hurricanes. Do you remember what movie that was?
Shit. The name escapes me right now, but I hate that movie. It scares the living shit out of me. Remind me what it's called, because I can't.
Fire in the Sky?
Fire in the Sky. Oh my God, I hate that movie. I don't hate it. I love it. It scares the living crap out of me, though.
Yeah, it's pretty unique amongst the alien abduction movies, because they do kind of show a lot of torture porn in it.
Yeah. And then like my, I don't know, 8-year-old self I mean, watching that movie, I mean, give me a break. I tried watching the movie semi-recently, and it wasn't as bad, obviously, because I have been exposed to more, you know, bullshit.
Gruesome bullshit.
Some gruesome bullshit. But, you know, my 8-year-old self, man, that shit scared the bejesus out of me. Oh my God. And even to this day, like, it still kind of scares me. It just doesn't have the same jarring effect, but it's so freaking creepy, man. Because that's pretty much what I envision for an alien abduction, period.
I don't know. I envision there being a lot less torture. But you know that it is based on a true story, right?
I do know that, which is why it's even scarier.
Well, have you ever wondered how much of that story is allegedly true? And what are the facts as we know them?
Sure. Yeah. Like now me, yes. Then me, no. If that makes sense.
It makes sense. Now, the following is from an All That's Interesting article by Marco Margaritov, a skeptic article by Dr. Michael Shermer, and a whole host of other sources I'll sprinkle throughout. Links in the show notes.
Show notes.
On November 5th, 1975, Travis Walton and his 6-man group of loggers were returning home after a long day's work in Sitegreaves National Forest in Arizona when they allegedly spotted a shiny disc spanning 40 feet in diameter hovering in the sky above them. Travis Walton got out of the vehicle to get a closer look and was hit with a beam of light. The rest of the crew got scared and took off in the truck as fast as they could. Thinking that Travis was dead, they reported it to the authorities. The authorities didn't believe the story and questioned the men, believing Travis had been murdered by his colleagues. When Travis reappeared 5 days later, a full-scale investigation that included polygraphs, psychological evaluations, and physical examinations began. All the men, except for one, passed the polygraph test, and they all maintained they saw a UFO. Travis insisted he was abducted the whole time he was missing and wrote a best-selling book that inspired the movie Fire in the Sky. But what really happened that day? Before we go through all the evidence, which I'll admit, there is not a lot of, what are your thoughts about Travis Walton and the movie Fire in the Sky?
Well, I think I already gave my thoughts. That movie's pretty creepy, and...
In all fairness to me, I had only asked you if you remember the name of the movie. You're the one that went off into all that other discourse.
Whatever he told people happened and what they put in this film has scarred me for life. So, you know, if it's going to be anything like, what was the other movie that we discussed with the...
Ronald Hunkeller?
Yeah, right? The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be anything like that, oh my God. Jesus Christ. Let's proceed, I guess.
We'll see. Let's take a look at the evidence and we'll see where it takes us.
All right. It's going to take us to Tampico.
It will not take us to Tampico, but it will take us to Arizona. Speaking of Arizona, the Arizona Daily Sun from Saturday, November 8th, 1975 will fill in a few of those gaps, but we'll have to look at some information from Wikipedia that cited a couple of books to fill in some of the other gaps. There was no author provided in the Arizona Daily Sun article, but have AP in quotes suggesting that they got it from Associated Press. In this article, Navajo County Sheriff Marlon Gillespie confirmed that his department was investigating the disappearance of 22-year-old Travis Walton from Snowflake, Arizona, which sounds adorable, whose companions claimed vanished after being struck by a ray of light from an unidentified flying object. Travis and his 6 companions had been in the Turkey Springs area near Heber thinning trees. Gillespie found no discrepancies in the reports given by the other 6 men, and the men agreed to be examined by a polygraph expert later that week. The 6 men told Gillespie that the group was driving on a forest road when they spotted a lighted object hovering above the ground near the road. When the men stopped, Travis got out of the truck and ran to the object. And in all fairness, I would have done the exact same thing.
You think so?
Yeah.
Now, looking back, you would still do that.
And that's the one of my dreams, is to get abducted.
No! I would not allow you to, but okay, continue.
Right, so the men told Gillespie that they witnessed Travis being struck by a ray of bluish light, and they were frightened and drove off, leaving Travis. They returned to the area 15 minutes later, but the hovering object and Travis were gone. UFOs the Public Deceived by Philip J. Klass was cited by Wikipedia and elaborated a little more on the story and states that the men had initially contacted police officer L.C. Ellison at 7:45 p.m. on the night of November 5th, and Ellison, Sheriff Marlon Gillespie, and Deputy Kenneth Copeland drove to Heber to meet with the men. Two of the crew members agreed to go with the officers back to Turkey Springs and search the area until about midnight. The other men refused to return and went home in the pickup they had all been in. At midnight, the search was paused by Gillespie until the morning. At 1:30 a.m., Deputy Copeland and Michael Rogers, the logging crew chief who had been with the crew, went to Travis's mother's house to give her the news of her son's disappearance. Deputy Copeland stated he was shocked by how calmly Travis's mother took the news and her lack of surprise. She also commented, quote, "Well, that's the way these things happen." Since Travis's family didn't have phone service, Rogers and Deputy Copeland drove the mother into town so she could call her son and daughter and let them know that their brother had disappeared. Copeland was once again shocked by how well the family took the news. That's kind of weird, right?
Extremely, yes. I'm pretty sure that if you or one of our other siblings would go missing, it would not be taken lightly at all.
No, not at all. I would expect my mom, at a minimum, to be hysterical if a cop and my boss from work showed up to her house and told her that I had disappeared.
Your boss. Yeah, no, for sure.
I imagine you and our brother to react much like Travis's siblings, but I would expect our mother to be hysterical.
And now I think you don't give us enough credit. Maybe Ponchito. He's really good at hiding his emotions or like keeping them in or whatever. But yeah, I definitely would be hysterical.
Oh, well.
I don't know. I mean, let's also go with Giselle and Alex. I'm pretty sure Rosa would also be just as hysterical. And we would all be equally as dumbfounded and worried. So either way.
I don't know. I kind of imagine my dad having the same flat affect that he has when any news is shared with him. So I think that he will be like the only one that's unmoved, probably.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, notice how I said Rosa and our mother, but my, yeah, like our dad. I think unless he really had to worry, he wouldn't. You know what I mean? Like, unless he really knew he had to, if that really makes sense. Like, at first, he probably thinks, it's just, you know, them being adults or them being kids or whatever. And then eventually, when you're not being found, he would start to worry.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe he'll be, he's just being a crazy teen.
No, that's just my opinion. But none of us are teens anymore, so.
Oh, yeah, huh? Right. So on November 7th, a search party of nearly 50 people searched the Turkey Springs area, but failed to find Travis or any sign of an altercation. The police officers were once again surprised when the mother said that there was no use in looking for Travis, as she didn't believe he was there or on this earth. So the sheriff dismissed all the volunteers who were looking for Travis. Rogers and Dwayne is Travis's brother, complained about the discontinued search, and Gillespie once again assembled another search party and a helicopter that went out to search the following day. Now, the following was cited by Wikipedia from the book UFO Abductions, A Dangerous Game, which is also by Philip J. Klass. He loves writing about UFO abductions and UFO stories. It's November 8th now. The new search party goes out to search for Travis, and regional newspapers start covering the story. That's the same day a member of a Phoenix-based UFO group conducted a 65-minute interview with Mike Rogers, the leader of the logging crew, and Dwayne Walton, Travis's brother. Both men expressed confidence that Travis would be returned. Rogers also discusses the logging contract his group had and said that they were seriously behind schedule since no work had been done since Wednesday and their contract was up on Monday. It was now Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
From what I could find about this contract, if they didn't finish by Monday, the group was going to be fined $2,500 or $14,500 in 2024 money, according to the inflation calculator.
Ooh, that's a big inflation.
Yep. Rogers did mention that the forestry contract did include an act of God clause that excused contractors who were delinquent due to unforeseeable circumstances and hoped that this incident would be taken into account. And I think that this is what Americans call putting your foot in your mouth.
I don't think being abducted by an alien is considered an act of God.
I kind of agree, but I guess that's all they had to go on.
Right.
On November 9th, law enforcement continued searching for Travis until otra vez la mamá me dice, Travis's mom requested the search be halted again. By November 10th, Travis's disappearance was being covered by the news nationally, as well as in Canada and the UK. On November 11th, the six remaining members of the logging crew were interrogated by the Arizona Department of Public Safety to determine if the men had murdered Travis. All the men denied harming Travis, and C.E. Gilson, the polygraph examiner, determined that five of the six men were being truthful. The sixth man was inconclusive. So let's discuss Travis's miraculous reappearance and the results of his first polygraph test after we return from this quick commercial break.
India.
Kilo.
Uniform.
Zulu.
Oscar.
Ikuzo.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Luca.
And here we go. Genuine, uncensored, and unscripted about pop culture, philosophy, politics, science, sports, and everything else beyond and under the sun. So get your headsets ready
for honest opinions, shower thoughts, barbershop talk, and city rumors, depending on what you seek.
But expect nothing less than a bohemian atmosphere and bond with our vibes, as we promise our pod won't cause any brain damage and that nobody will die from the cringe. And from time to time, we know to go overtime.
Charted and trusted by thousands on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and basically everywhere. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Central European Time. That's around 11 a.m. for Americans. And overtime, every now and then, out of nowhere.
I think that was all of our catchphrases. Now you can go and check our podcast yourself and witness that we don't just talk the talk. We walk the walk.
Ikuzo!
Aussie Afterlife is a podcast that retells true paranormal stories and presents real audio evidence such as EVPs from my own paranormal investigations. My name is Sam, and I am the sole creator and host of this enthralling podcast. I have always had a deep fascination and love for the paranormal. So naturally, I thought, well, why not create a podcast? Like, I'm 35. I've got to make myself relevant in some way, right? I was always surprised at how many everyday people have had paranormal experiences. Like, we all can't be wrong or going mad. Well, we can, but no, we can't. I'm going to stick with you. Can't all be wrong. Otherwise, I'd have to come to the realization that I've wasted an enormous amount of time. Anyway, if you want to hear true paranormal stories and real ghostly voices, come join Aussie Afterlife. It's the most fun you'll have with your clothes on. Or you might not have clothes on. I wouldn't know either way. Oh, that adds a different layer of mystery again, doesn't it? See? It's exciting already. Come on. Press play. You know you want to.
And we're back.
We're back.
Were you abducted by aliens during our break?
Briefly, and then I was returned.
Excellent. Were you administered any polygraph test relating to Travis Walton's disappearance?
I was not.
So what are your thoughts about everything that we've learned so far?
I don't know. It's kind of weird. The mom is being kind of weird. I guess it's not just the mom and the family members, the brothers, the sister. They're being kind of weird about it. The friends are passing except for one. But I also do know that polygraph tests are not admissible in a court of law because of how faulty those tests can be. So I guess it just depends on whether or not you really do believe in what you're saying.
That is true. And we're actually going to talk about polygraph tests in a bit.
Okay.
But and it wasn't that six member didn't pass. It was just inconclusive.
Right.
So shortly after midnight on the morning of November 12th, Travis placed a collect call to his sister's home from a payphone in Heber, Arizona. His brother-in-law, Grant Neff, answered and drove to pick up Travis's brother, Dwayne. The two then went to pick up Travis. The collect call operator recognized Travis's name and alerted Sheriff Gillespie, who dispatched Deputy Glenn Flake to the Walton family home. The brother-in-law later reported he initially thought Travis was intoxicated. Deputy Flake arrived at the Walton home at 2 a.m. and witnessed Dwayne transferring fuel from one vehicle to another. Deputy Flake did not reveal that law enforcement knew that Travis had returned home, and Dwayne did not tell the deputy that Travis had returned. Dwayne tried to seek medical attention for Travis by reaching out to a UFO researcher he met days prior, since we all know that UFO researchers are medical professionals.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, but okay.
That is very weird. Now, I couldn't find out if this was the same researcher who had done the interview a few days before where they divulged the specifics of their logging contract, but the UFO researcher did refer them to a hypnotherapist named Dr. Lester Stewart. Doctor has quotes around it. Stewart stated that Travis needed a medical examination with lab tests and was not ready for hypnotic regression. Stewart noted that Travis seemed very confused and reminiscent of drug addicts he treated. Stewart also noted that Travis had a small lesion on the inside crease of his right elbow that was consistent with intravenous drug use. I'll let you correct me. No. Did I say it right?
You said it right this time.
All right. The Waltons returned to Dwayne's home, where UFO researchers arranged for two medical doctors who were also amateur UFO investigators to examine Travis. Dwayne did not allow them to use their camera or tape recorder or ask Travis about his experience. The doctors did note the puncture mark on the arm and estimated that it was 24 to 48 hours old. So that's weird, right? But maybe the puncture wound was how the aliens were keeping Travis fed and hydrated.
Yeah, but it was only 24 to 48 hours old. So how long was he missing again?
He was missing for 5 days.
I don't know. Sounds kind of fishy now to me.
Yeah. I guess looking at it, I kind of figured, you know, it kind of sounds like maybe he was on heroin or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just me and my mind that tends to go to dark places.
Yeah, sounds like he had a really bad trip, and maybe that's why the mom and the brother and the sister weren't as worried, because they knew that he's done stuff like that before.
Maybe. I hadn't really thought of that. I kind of thought that maybe they knew where he was all along, and that's why they just couldn't be bothered, because they were like, oh, you know, we know that he didn't get abducted. We know exactly where he's at. And that's why they didn't make a big deal about it. But that's the way that I felt personally when I got to this part of all the research. So that day, news of Travis's return had spread, and the media began calling Dwayne's home, trying to reach Travis. At this time, Dwayne also notified Sheriff Gillespie that Travis had returned, and Gillespie insisted on seeing Travis immediately. He arrived at 11 p.m., and Dwayne and Travis demanded that Gillespie not record the interview. The UFO group facilitated a connection with the National Enquirer, who moved Dwayne and Travis into a suite at the Sheraton Inn in Scottsdale in exchange for exclusive access to Travis and his story. Travis skipped the polygraph with police, but in the presence of National Enquirer reporters and a doctor associated with the UFO group, he did agree to be hypnotized, interviewed, and polygraphed by Jack McCarthy, a freelance polygraph examiner. McCarthy stated that Travis was engaged in a gross deception and had even intentionally held his breath in an attempt to beat the machine.
Sounds legit, yeah.
So Phoenix television station, K-O-O-L, Cool Phoenix, interviewed Travis on November 22nd about the incident. Travis claimed that he lost consciousness when struck by the beam of light, and he awoke in a hospital-like room while being observed by three short bald creatures. He fought with them until a human wearing a helmet led Travis to another room where he blacked out as three other humans put a clear plastic mask over his face. Travis claims he remembers nothing else until he found himself walking along a highway 5 days later as the flying saucer flew above him.
Could it have been maybe a stroke of lightning?
You got to remember there's six other observers who claim to have witnessed the same thing.
Well, they could have seen like a lightning strike, and then this guy just I don't know, collapse and they got scared and then they ran off and came up with the story. And then if he was on drugs, that can also explain why he's hallucinating and seeing these things.
That's very possible. Let's see what else we can find.
All right.
On July 31st, 2008, Dr. Michael Shermer was asked to appear on the Fox TV show, The Moment of Truth, which is a show where contestants were offered money in exchange for telling the truth about something in their life. Now, unfortunately, the clips on YouTube were taken down, so I didn't actually watch them, but I'm going to go off of Shermer's reporting of the event. And I feel like Dr. Shermer needs no introduction, but for those that are unfamiliar, he has degrees in psychology, experimental psychology, and a PhD in the history of science. He's a science writer and focuses mainly on pseudoscience, critical thinking, and skepticism. He is also the founder of Skeptic Magazine, which focuses on investigating pseudoscience and supernatural claims. And he's also written a ton of books on why people believe nonsense. So Dr. Shermer was brought on the show to question Travis about his alien abduction. He asked if Travis had any evidence to support his claim of being abducted. He said that of course he did, because his co-workers saw it happen. Now, Dr. Shermer mentions in his analysis that it was convenient that it happened right before the loggers' November 10th deadline, which they were about to miss, and they would be docked 10% of their contract payment unless an act of God prevented the completion. Shermer also stated that for years, Travis and his older brother Dwayne had talked about UFOs they'd seen in Arizona, and they had even made a pact that if one of them was abducted, they would insist that the aliens abduct the other brother as well. Coincidentally, 2 weeks before the Walton abduction and logging deadline, NBC aired their made-for-TV movie about the 1961 Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, which at the time was the most well-known alien abduction case. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about it here, but if you're interested, we talk about it on our August 22nd, 2022 episode, Project Blue Book. He agrees with Philip Klass's opinion in the book UFO Abductions that Travis and his buddies just made up the story as an excuse to account for not being able to complete their logging project on time per their contract. And this based on Klass discovering that during the 5 days that Walton was missing, as we stated, none of his family members or coworkers showed any concern for Travis's safety during several interviews with the media and interrogations by law enforcement. Klass also learned that while Travis did pass one polygraph test by a UFO organization, Travis had dictated to the administrator of the test what questions would be asked. So in other words, he said, I'll only take this polygraph test if you agree to only ask me these following questions.
Right.
The one that he didn't pass was conducted by Jack McCarthy, was not published, but was discovered by Klass during his investigation, and McCarthy had concluded that Travis's story was a gross deception and held his breath to try and defeat the polygraph. And Jack McCarthy was actually a well-known, well-respected polygraph administrator. It wasn't some guy from a UFO organization that it just administered it.
All right.
So going back to the show, The Moment of Truth, Travis was once again hooked up to a polygraph for a chance to win $100,000 on TV. All he had to do was answer the truth. He answered yes to Shermer's question of having evidence of his abduction, because he does believe that his six co-workers witnessing the abduction was evidence. The polygraph said that was true. The next question was if Travis was abducted by a UFO on November 5th, 1975. Travis answered yes. The polygraph said that was false, and Travis won nothing. Now, Shermer stated that it took a Fox reality show to finally put that story to bed, but not before Travis released a best-selling book which inspired the popular movie Fire in the Sky. Now, Shermer is the first to say that, to be fair, the polygraph test is unreliable, and he had even done a two-part special on Fox Family where he debunked the polygraph. But for most people, that meant that Travis's story was a lie, and with that also went the excitement for his story. He did say that he spoke to and interviewed Travis about the incident and found him to be an exceptionally likable man and a nice guy, but he still thinks the polygraph is not a reliable determiner of truth, and he does not think that Travis was abducted by aliens. He stated that the power of deception and self-deception is all we need to understand what really happened in 1975. So what do you think of Dr. Michael Shermer's assessment?
I think that it's very valid, and I agree.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really much you can say about that. I think he pretty much says it all, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I believe in other life besides our own, but I do not believe that they possess the technology to be able to get here alive because of how far away we are, which is why I don't believe that the alien abduction occurred. However, that movie still scares the shit out of me.
No, it is fair. I think of all the alien abduction movies that I've ever seen, that's probably the scariest.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of sad now that, I mean, now I'm going to look at it and just be like, oh, it's just all hoax. Just like everything else in my life.
My whole life has been a lie.
Yes, my whole life.
No, and I agree with you. I do definitely believe that there's life on other planets. But I think the main barrier to traveling here is being able to conquer the speed of light, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take somebody years to get here. And more likely than not, they're not going to be alive. I think if anything, they're going to do the same that we do. And we send out drones and fucking robots and shit to explore other planets. Just because, well, first of all, you don't put life at risk. And second, those things can keep on going. Like Voyager has been going for like over 40 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still capturing information. It's starting to go senile now because like the tape that it was recorded on is starting to make errors. But I mean, it still reports every once in a while.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that for sure. 100%.
And if a UFO were to land, I would be the first one to get out of my truck and run near it.
I mean, you keep saying that, but I don't know. I feel like you would run away.
I'm scared of most things, but that would be one thing that I would be willing to risk my life for, just because I want to see what these beings look like and what their spaceships look like and what other technology they have. I think that would be worth it for me.
I'm good not knowing.
Anything else you wanted to add?
No, nothing else. It was really good, really interesting.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It's kind of sad. I'm all kind of sad.
It is sad to learn that the things that you really enjoyed and you
grew up thinking were an absolute nightmare and maybe might be true, might have been a total lie. Just like everything else in your life.
Well, I've come to that sad realization multiple times throughout my life, so.
Yeah.
All right, so this week's whiskey pick is an old bourbon staple that, much like Dr. Michael Shermer, needs no introduction. One of the best bottles of whiskeys you can buy for less than $25. Plus, we talked about this company extensively during the Pappy Van Winkle bourbon heist episode, so I can't not talk about it. I'm talking about the one, the only Wild Turkey 101. It's been made for over 60 years using master distiller Jimmy Russell's recipe. There is no age statement on the bottle, but Wild Turkey claims to be aged between 6 to 8 years. Jimmy Russell has been with Wild Turkey for almost 70 years. He first started with the company in 1954. His son, Eddie, started working at Wild Turkey in 1981 and became master distiller in 2015. Jimmy and Eddie are the only active father and son duo of master distillers in the world. Now, Wild Turkey goes back to the Rippey brothers, who opened up the distillery on Wild Turkey Hill in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky back in 1869, going under the name of Rippey Distillery. They changed their name to Wild Turkey in 1940 when a distillery executive shared his bourbon with friends on an annual hunting trip where they were hunting for Wild Turkey. Even though the company has been around since 1869, Jimmy Russell was only their third master distiller and was one that came up with the Wild Turkey 101 mash bill or recipe, which is 75% corn, 13% rye, and 12% barley. And that's pretty much their mash bill now for all of their bourbons, and they produce different flavor profiles by aging it for different periods of time and storing it at different warehouses, one of those being one that was easily accessible by the gang that were trying to steal the Pappy Van Winkle bourbon.
Right. Wow, that's cool.
Coming in at 101 proof and with a high rye mash bill, gives it a good kick, but still manages to be smooth and tastes amazing. The aging takes away a lot of the harshness that you would expect from something at 101 proof. The price tag makes it a great daily sipper, and the high proof makes it great for mixing. Wild Turkey describes the taste as sweet up front with vanilla and caramel notes with oak and baking spices in the middle. It is aged in number 4 charred oak barrels, but the smokiness is not overwhelming. It's definitely there, but it's not as smoky as something like Old Forester or Woodford Reserve. And for $25, it can't be beat, and it's better than many bourbons costing twice as much. As you could see by the bottle, I've drank a lot, so I really like it. It's one that I always keep in stock, and it's one that I give a definite buy recommendation.
So tell me, how much of that did you have today?
Today I have had none.
Oh.
The slurred speech is all from being tired.
Oh. A second question. Are they sponsoring us?
Oh, well, you probably haven't heard the last episode that I did, but I've actually gotten a lot of people that have started talking to me about whiskey because of the great Pappy Van Winkle episode.
Oh, okay.
Writing to tell me, hey, you know, do you like this whiskey? Do you like that whiskey? And, you know, of course, our amazing super homie, super friend Eric sent us a bottle of whiskey.
Yes, which I still want to try. Wait, it's not the one that you took this last time to our dad's, right?
No, the one I took to my dad's was Monkey Shoulder.
Oh, yeah, it was Monkey Shoulder. Yeah.
That one is a scotch, and that one is definitely going to be a recommendation in the future. Yeah, so what I decided is, since I've gotten a few people that have written in because of the whiskey and their curiosity about it, I'm going to start doing a whiskey pick on my episodes.
Okay. Well, I hope that these people start to listen in and start sponsoring us. Because you're giving them free publicity and advertising. I was like, wait, did I miss something? Are they sponsoring us?
You did, because actually that episode, I haven't even finished mixing it yet. Like, it'll be the one that'll come out on Patreon on Sunday. So I have to hurry the fuck up and finish mixing it and editing it. But yeah, it's just something I'm going to start doing until either I run out of whiskey or I don't know. I feel like I've named all the ones that I really like.
Okay, that's cool.
I've got, I think one of the patrons, I put a picture of all my bottles, and I haven't counted them, but I have at least maybe like 50 bottles, if not more.
Oh my gosh.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, even if I do one every other week, it'll be a few years before I go through the ones that I recommend.
A few years. Ah, va bien, va bien.
So yeah, that's the whiskey pick of the week.
Cool. You need to come up with like a little jingle for that. Bum, ba-da, bum, bum, bum.
Baka!
Baka! Baka, ba, ba. Well, you know, Wild Turkey.
Yeah.
Más o menos.
Very appropriate. And I think these guys also, they were logging in some place called Turkey Springs. Let me go back, because I don't even remember anymore.
And on that high note.
Yeah, they were in Turkey Springs, is where they were thinning trees.
Oh, okay.
So, turkey, all the things. I can't do the turkey impression like you do it, though. So, special shout out to our super homie, super friends, Sophia, Natasha, Eric, Angie, Eli, Madtown Charity, and our newest patron, Katya. If you want to be super cool and help support the show, get the episodes a week early and ad-free, get your name shouted out on the show, and get some stickers from us a few times a year, check us out at patreon.com/technicallyaconversation, or check the show notes.
Show notes.
Best of all, it's only $2 a month, baby. You can't even buy cigarettes or a bottle of Wild Turkey 101 for that.
Definitely not.
We hope that you enjoy the show and you join us again next week. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a review, tell a friend, and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Follow us on the socials at GreetingsTAC, email us at GreetingsTAC@gmail.com,
or
leave us a voicemail at 915-317-6669. If you have a story of when you were abducted by aliens, to share with us.
That was horrible.
On next week's episode of Technically a Conversation.
In 1992, high school students and staff from an El Paso, Texas high school were being constantly harassed by U.S. Border Patrol. Agents were aggressively yelling at them, demanding to prove their citizenship. One lady was knocked to the ground and kicked 20 times by agents. The abuse could no longer be tolerated, so several students, these alums, and some staff decided to sue the U.S. Border Patrol. Come root for the underdog and get all the details next on Technically a Conversation.
New episodes drop Monday. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a show.